you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
A good Sunday to you. This is the weekend edition of the LA Report. I'm Julia Paskin, and coming up after the headlines, we'll introduce you to one man who said he was forced to wait for 8 months in Tijuana. That was under a Trump administration policy that blocked asylum seekers from entering the U.S. through Mexico by land. Then, the latest in the case of an LA sheriff's deputy who shot and killed an unarmed man who was experiencing a mental health crisis. His family had called for help. After he was killed in 2021, they sought justice. We have an important update on that ongoing story. That's all coming up in a bit, but first, the news. Someone drove an SUV into a street carnival on Trinity and 38th Street in South LA last night. Six people between the ages of 30 and 50 years old were hospitalized with injuries that were remarkably not life-threatening. We will bring you more details later this morning. And in other news, the LA County Homeless Initiative is recommending almost $600 million in funding next year for a range of services for people experiencing homelessness. The proposed budget includes more spending for interim housing, permanent housing, and supportive services. Much of the funding comes from Measure H, the 1/4-cent sales tax approved for 10 years in 2017. Sherry Todoroff is the initiative's executive director. She says much of the plan was drafted based on listening sessions with homeless outreach organizations and people experiencing homelessness.
They really directed us to focus on people who have the most complex conditions experiencing homelessness, as they need additional supports to move from homelessness to housing. And they also directed us to make deeper investments in permanent housing placements.
The Homeless Initiative is now asking for public feedback through November 22nd. The full proposal, as well as the public comment form, can be found at homeless.lacounty.gov. We have a few election updates after yesterday's vote count. Looking at the race for mayor, Congresswoman Karen Bass has widened her lead over developer Rick Caruso by more than 9,000 votes. Bass now has almost 307,000 votes, and Caruso has 297,000. And in the LA County Sheriff's race, former Long Beach Police Chief Robert Luna now leads incumbent Sheriff Alex Villanueva by nearly 260,000 votes. And in the race for LA County Supervisor, West Hollywood City Councilwoman Lindsay Horvath is leading State Senator Bob Hertzberg by less than a point. And COVID-19 cases in LA County are slowly but steadily rising, and that has health officials concerned about a cold weather surge. Another worry, the low number of county residents who have actually gotten their bivalent booster. So far, that's only about 1 in 10 people who are eligible. We're also seeing more cases of the flu and the respiratory illness known as RSV. LA County Health Director Barbara Ferrer says it's important that we all wash our hands, wipe down surfaces, and wear masks around high-risk people.
Knowing that we're facing the possibility of having multiple respiratory illnesses circulating all at the same time and stressing our healthcare system, we all can be sure to do the things we know that work to prevent spreading respiratory illness.
Another tip from Ferrer, get your free flu vaccine at the same time you get your COVID booster. It turns out a parasite that infects humans lives in bodies of water here in Southern California, and it's widespread. That's a finding from a new study out of Scripps Institution of Oceanography. These flatworms get into fish and can infect humans if the fish is ingested raw. Ryan Heckinger authored the study and says there is no need to panic, though, as long as you freeze your fish or cook it before eating it.
This is a serious issue, but it's not a grave issue because it's so easy to avoid the problem and still eat what you want to eat.
Heckinger hopes the study will lead to signs being properly put up at fishing spots warning people to cook the fish they catch. He also hopes doctors will keep these parasites in mind when dealing with people who are sick. Do you ever forget to just look up? Well, if you do remember to occasionally gaze upward and you know how to look, you can see an array of majestic birds in Southern California skies and right from your neighborhood. For some guidance, we're joined by Joan Strassman. She's the author of the new book, Slow Birding, The Art and Science of Enjoying the Birds in Your Own Backyard. Joan, welcome.
Thank you. Can you define slow birding compared to the kind of typical type of bird watching that usually comes to mind?
I guess what is most commonly done with birds is they're seen, identified, and counted. And then people move on to the next bird. I like to start with a little bit more appreciation of the birds, what they're doing, what's going on with them, and doing that in fewer rather than more places.
How about an example of a bird we can spot in the greater LA area?
Oh, you have lots of wonderful birds. One of the commonest birds is the white-crowned sparrow. It's a close relative of the white-throated sparrow, which I talk about in my book. Other birds, house sparrows, starlings, cedar waxwings, Cooper's hawks, flickers, juncos are there in the winter. And then you have marvelous woodpeckers. So yeah, there's lots of birds, and it's really gratifying to just get to know the couple dozen that are right in your neighborhood.
And what about the time of day you step outside? Is there an ideal window for bird watching?
Early morning is really the best time to see birds. They're out there all the time, but they may be quiet, not singing, harder to see. I would say that sort of 10 or 11 a.m. to 3 or 4 p.m. is probably a tough time to see birds, except, of course, shorebirds.
And what kind of songs and sounds can we hear from birds if we know how to listen?
I think that the best thing to do is to download the free app called Merlin, which you can put on, and then it'll tell you exactly what you're hearing. My nephew's wife just sent us a recording from San Diego, and it was lots of chatter, and she didn't know what it was, and it turns out it was the white-crowned sparrows. So I hear them a lot when I'm in LA.
For folks who want to attract birds, maybe with a feeder in their window in their apartment, or if you have a backyard, what could they do to create an environment that birds want to visit?
Seeds are great. Lots of bird feeders are there with seeds. You can also put out fruit. A half orange might attract orioles or some tanagers. Hummingbird feeders are really great in your area. The other thing birds really need is water. So if you can put out a bird bath or have a little pond or something like that, that works. When I lived in Berlin, we only had a balcony, and we put food out on the balcony ledge, and then also a little water dish.
So I gotta say, I wanted to check out your book because I feel like I know a lot of people who are really benefiting from taking the time after a crazy day to just be still and see what birds and other wildlife comes to hang out. It seems to bring people a lot of peace. So can you speak to that side of this more relaxed, kind of locally focused bird watching?
To me, it's been really amazing how once I started really listening to the birds, how enriching that was, and how there were birds I heard every day and had never figured out what they were. And then once I did figure out what they were, I just felt like an old friend when I heard that bird. I just think that so often bird watchers will skip right to the identifying. We skip that first step where we just listen and try to classify what we're hearing in our own mind before letting anyone else sort of tell us, oh, you know, that's a certain bird, that's a house sparrow, or that's a mockingbird, that's a Abare's towhee.
That's Joan Strassman, author of the new book, Slow Birding, The Art and Science of Enjoying the Birds in Your Own Backyard. That's out now. Joan, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
We'll be back after this short break.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
Welcome back to the LA Report. I'm Julia Paskin. Under former President Donald Trump, the government put stringent policies in place to block most people seeking asylum in the U.S. One policy led to mass expulsions and is still in effect under President Biden. Another forced asylum seekers to wait in Mexico, is slowly winding down. Recently, our immigrant communities correspondent Leslie Berstein Rojas spoke with one Venezuelan, an asylum seeker who waited nearly 8 months in Tijuana. He told us his story.
Yonaikul Vielma Belandria arrived in Tijuana in April of 2019. He'd made his way up from Venezuela, where he'd been a college student. Like others, he'd joined protests against the repressive government of Venezuelan President Nicolás Maduro.
La economía estaba destruida.
The economy was destroyed, and at the social level as well. So we went out to march, to protest.
Vielma says his activism led to trouble.
A mí me amenazaron, follaron a mi casa.
He says he was threatened by pro-government paramilitaries who came to his home. He decided to leave. He made it first to Guatemala, where he stayed a while, then continued on to Tijuana. There, he went to the border crossing to ask for political asylum. Instead, he was given a number and told he would have to wait in Tijuana. His turn would come up in 4 months.
I nearly fainted because I thought, wow, I can't wait 4 months. I only have 50 Mexican pesos in my pocket. It's like $2.50.
Volunteers referred him to a migrant shelter. There, Vielma waited, cooking and helping other migrants in exchange for a roof and meals. In August of 2019, he got his asylum interview with an immigration official at the border. He was given a date to appear in immigration court in San Diego, but then he was sent back to Tijuana.
And so began my asylum case, but not in United States territory. That's the curious thing.
Vielma had become caught up in what's known as Remain in Mexico. Starting in 2019, the policy forced thousands of asylum seekers who were not from Mexico to nonetheless stay there as they were shuttled back and forth across the border to court hearings.
El día comenzaba así, me tenían que presentar a las 5 o 6 de la mañana.
Vielma describes these court trips. He had to be at the border crossing by 5 or 6 a.m.
Ellos pasaban la lista.
They would pass the list around. We were 30, 50 people there waiting to go to court altogether. Then we would get on a bus in order and go to court.
The process took all day, he says. The judge would ask if anyone was afraid to return to Mexico. Vielma regrets having said yes. He says he was sent to a chilly holding cell that migrants refer to as hieleras, or ice boxes.
If you responded yes, they would detain you for 3 days in the hielera so that they could interview you, which served no purpose because they would just send you back to Mexico again.
But he had reason to be afraid. Foreign asylum seekers stranded in Mexico's border cities have been assaulted, some even killed. Vielma says he once saw two men beating a fellow migrant outside the drop-in center where he worked. Then, he says they grabbed the man by the shirt and took him away. Vielma worried for his own safety. For these and other reasons, most of the tens of thousands of people in the Remain in Mexico program dropped out over time. The Biden administration ended Remain in Mexico in August after the Supreme Court ruled in its favor following a long legal battle with GOP-led states. The asylum seekers are gradually being paroled into the U.S. as their court dates come up. Vielma got in sooner than many others. After three cross-border court hearings, he was ordered deported in late 2019. But Venezuela wouldn't take him back. After some months in detention, he was released with an ankle monitor. He's now living in Moreno Valley with relatives, and his asylum case has been reopened. He says the experience wore him down, but he's glad he didn't give up.
They want for you to give up. But I think that first, they'll get tired before the need that human beings have to find a better life.
Other Venezuelans arriving at the border now may not have that chance. Under a new Biden policy, most Venezuelan asylum seekers who arrive by land are being turned back. Only a small number of Venezuelans will be allowed to come temporarily by air. And even though Biden has ended the Remain in Mexico policy, its backers are not giving up. Texas and Missouri went back to court in August in hopes of reinstating it. I'm Leslie Berstein Rojas.
This week, L.A. County District Attorney George Gascon announced that Sheriff's Deputy Ramin Pineda has been charged with the unlawful shooting of David Ordaz Jr., who was fatally shot while on the ground outside his family's East L.A. home in March 2021. Pineda faces two felony counts, and he'll be arraigned at a later date. The case remains under investigation. Last year, our Robert Garova met with Ordaz's grieving family. Haunted by what had happened, they sought a long-term solution on how law enforcement deals with mental health crises. Here's Robert's report.
There's a push in LA to make emergency responses to mental health crises more safe. For many, that means moving away from using armed law enforcement. In the meantime, families continue to see their relatives die at the hands of the people who were supposed to help. I'm Robert Garova. On a warm day in Montebello, eight of David Ordaz Jr.'s relatives convene in the backyard of his sister's home to remember him. They sit semicircle on patio furniture, a box of tissues at the ready. Older sister Hilda Pedroza says the 34-year-old Ordaz had a kind heart.
If there was a gathering, he would skim the room and look for that one person that was on the site, and he would go and talk to them. That was the kind of person that he was.
Growing up one of five siblings at the family's home in East L.A., Ordaz spent a lot of time at the Our Lady of Lourdes Church on 3rd Street. He and his two brothers were altar boys there.
Very playful. He loved his games. He loved the Dodgers. He loved the Raiders. A very happy person.
Then, in his late teens, Ordaz struggled with his mental health. He was diagnosed with anxiety and panic disorder, but he was able to manage this. Ordaz worked in construction, and he had three kids with his domestic partner. He lived on the same property as his dad, David Ordaz Sr., who says he and his son would hang out whenever they got the chance.
We would go out to grab a bite, to get haircuts, or to the store. I always saw him as a humble person, as a son who was good to me.
But a few years ago, Pedroza says the family was hit with bad news about Ordaz Sr.
The biggest heartache for all of us was finding out that my dad had cancer. And especially for David. David and my dad were best friends.
Ordaz and Pedroza did a lot of the caregiving for their dad. Then Ordaz Sr. got very sick with COVID-19. Another sister, Gabby Hernandez, remembers how that affected her brother.
He was internalizing a lot, and he felt a little bit of guilt, like, did I do something wrong? Did Dad catch COVID because of me? And I think it took a toll on him.
On March 14, Pedroza panicked after her brother told her he had a knife. She was worried he might try to take his own life. Pedroza tried to get help for David every way she knew how that day.
We had already gone to the hospital. He didn't want to get off right there. You know, I thought talking to all of us, that would help him. And he wasn't budging.
Eventually, she felt she had nowhere else to turn than law enforcement. Back when Ordaz had a couple of crises in 2006 and 7, sheriff's deputies were able to peacefully de-escalate the situation.
I thought about how they had helped us previously. You know, they're going to help us again.
The sheriff's department says deputies saw Ordaz sitting in a parked car in front of the family home in East L.A. They ordered him to exit the car, and as he did, the department says he was holding the knife in his right hand and telling deputies to shoot him. Sister Gabby Hernandez remembers what she saw that day.
When I arrived there, I was shocked to have seen that there were so many deputies and so many deputies with guns drawn. It just took me off guard. I was so in shock to see, like, what happened?
The sheriff's department says deputies opened fire when Ordaz charged at them while holding the knife. But cell phone video shared by the Ordaz family appears to show him holding a knife while standing on the sidewalk. He's facing deputies in the street who are just out of frame. A deputy fires two beanbags at him. Ordaz stumbles backwards, turns, and begins to run up the sidewalk. The deputies start shooting live rounds, hitting Ordaz several times. Sister Hilda Pedroza was watching all of this unfold.
They were shooting at him when he was already on the floor. But once everybody stopped, there was a pause, and there was one officer. His head was still up. He was still alive. That one officer did one shot, and we knew he was dead.
Ordaz's parents, two sisters, two brothers, and other relatives all witnessed the shooting. The family's attorney says he's preparing a wrongful death lawsuit against the county. The department says it's investigating the shooting and will release body cam video in the next few weeks. Meanwhile, Ordaz's family is trying to grieve and make sense of how David could be taken from them at such a young age. Emily Ordaz is one of David's children.
I love my sweet 16 this year, and
knowing all my family's gonna be there but him, it's like the worst thing, you know? We had so much time left with him.
Pedroza, who made the call to the sheriff's department trying to get help for her brother, says she's still haunted by what happened that day.
Everything reminds me of David. Everything reminds me of what happened. Going outside my house, even to my porch, you know? It gives me all these nightmares that I can't even sleep.
Gabby Hernandez says what happened to her brother has made her want to work on finding ways to improve how the department responds to mental health calls. To her, that means
reform, if it's, you know, and the training that the law enforcement get, if it's linking with mental health and getting the appropriate professionals to handle these cases, what do we need to do?
The patrol unit that responded to the Ordaz home had requested one of the department's mental evaluation teams. Made up of an armed deputy and a clinician from the Department of Mental Health, MET units are especially trained to de-escalate mental health crises. But the MET unit at the East LA station was unavailable that day because the deputy who staffed it was sick. The next closest team was dispatched from Lakewood and didn't make it in time. David Ordaz Sr. questions why the deputies didn't wait.
The police must do something to fix all these things, because if they don't, we will continue to lose children, to lose people in the community, and that's not fair.
Ordaz says he doesn't want to see another family go through the same pain. I'm Robert Garova.
Thank you for listening to the Sunday edition of the LA Report. Suzanne Watley and Nick Roman will be back again tomorrow with the AM and PM editions. Until then, enjoy the rest of your weekend and try to take it easy. I'm Julia Paskin. The LA Report is produced by Michael Cosentino. The Weekend LA Report is engineered by Sean Corey Campbell. On weekdays, the LA Report is engineered by Brandon Bowles and Tui Mao. Special thanks to the reporters, editors, and the entire KPCC LAist newsroom.
This program is made possible in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at laist.com/sweeps.